and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, December 13th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Putting a Bow on Her Career. Karen Tracy closing her sewing business after 32 years. It's written by Peggy Senzarino of the Sioux City Journal, and the dateline is Sioux City. Karen Tracy is getting ready for the next chapter of her life. The 68-year-old Sioux City costumer and seamstress is closing her home-based business after 32 years. She and husband Mike are moving to St. Louis, Missouri next month to be closer to their daughter and grandchildren. I want to do new things. It's time to find some new adventures and to get on with living. Keep it fresh and keep it new, she said, sitting in her basement sewing room. I want to stay active and young and make new friends. Tracy learned how to sew as a seventh grader. I was a dancer at Shirley's Dance Studio, and back in the day, when you wanted a costume, you didn't order it from a catalog, you had to make it. There were four of us girls in the family who took dance lessons. My mom was always kind of in a hurry to get our costumes done, and I pitched in to help, Tracy said. I showed a little bit of a knack for it. She encouraged me. I took lessons at the Singer Store downtown. She stayed involved with dance throughout her life, but her sewing talents were tested in many other ways in many other venues. She made costumes for high school mascots, the Iowa Cubs, and state parks, dancers competing at the Iowa State Fair, all the while still dueling alterations for men and women in Sioux City. I was always confident enough to say yes to whatever they asked me, she said. The first time I made a mascot, I didn't really know how to make a foam head, but I figured it out. That was kind of my gift. She recalls her first customer 32 years ago in Sioux City. She is going to be a hard one to leave, Tracy said. There's a lot of love through the door and some challenging work that was not maybe that enjoyable, but paid the bills. She sewed new stripes for the Desert Storm conflict in 2,000 uniforms for the Iowa National Guard. Your name just gets passed around. I've never advertised. It's all been an accidental word of mouth and nice people showed up. One of her favorite associations is the work she did on the renovations at the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City. I am very proud of the Orpheum Theater, she said. She sewed fringe on the curtains and made covers for the railings. She was one of only two women that worked in the rehab of the theater. She was a go-to person when a seamstress was needed for a Broadway show playing Sioux City. When they come, they always ask for a seamstress. On the road, things get torn. A knee might blow out. A sleeve might rip. They would need someone that can sew in an emergency, Tracy said. She got pulled into singer Barry Manilow's orbit when Manilow's wardrobe person was stricken with appendicitis. Tracy said they asked her to make vests and sequin dresses for a July 4th television appearance. I ended up making costumes that were on the national TV show, she said. I was very proud. She did work for dancers Derek and Julianne Hough. You never know what you'll be asked to do. It's a hard job. I enjoy it. I always enjoy it, Tracy said. She found that world has its own rules. Be aware that they are performers and you should not be intrusive. Don't take pictures. Be very respectful and stay out of their way. It's fun to be a part of that world to get out of my basement. Looking back on her life, she said she is happy with the choice she made to work from home. I had three kids, and my first job was to raise them, and I wanted to be here. It was a conscious decision to not go get a job where I had a paid vacation and retirement. I would have loved to have been a teacher. I wanted to be a mom first and stay here. It's an accidental life that I've enjoyed, Tracy said. As she and Mike prepare for their move to St. Louis, Tracy is planning to still do some sewing. There's not too many of us left. I might do it for a while. Not have as many people coming to my house, maybe. I think so for a store or there's a dance studio nearby that already kind of offered me a job. They make a lot of costumes for their students. They have 750 dance students. It's a huge studio. They said I could work one day, 2 days, 3 days, whatever I wanted. I might do that just to meet people, to get to know people, she said. Molly, the couple's 4-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, sat quietly in the cushy bed next to Tracy's sewing machine. I'm proudest of all the little kids I helped with costumes for state fairs, and those kids have grown up, and they have kids of their own that are dancing. I started with dance, and it will always be really important to me, she said. It will be fun to relive it without being in charge. I keep trying to retire. I got rid of my landline phone. That helps. There are still people who come and knock on my door. It's really hard to quit. She reflects on her new life coming in St. Louis. It's been a good life. I am looking forward to being a little free. We are not going to mow. We bought a condo. We're not going to shovel. We have a motorcycle. We like to hop on the bike and take little outings. We are going to head south. We've never been south, she said. Retirement will also mean trips to Colorado to visit sons Christopher and John and their children. Next is an article entitled, Council Hears Presentation About Gordon Drive Viaduct Replacement. It's written by Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal, and the dateline is Sioux City. The Sioux City Council heard a presentation Monday from the Iowa Department of Transportation about the Gordon Drive Viaduct Reconstruction Project. The 3,970-foot-long viaduct, built in 1937 and improved in 1963 and 1966, will be replaced with a 98-foot-wide viaduct. Dakin Schultz, IDOT District 3 Transportation Planner, told the council the IDOT is in the process of trying to determine the preferred alternative. The city's preferences are on-alignment viaduct, at-grade intersection alternative, include Cunningham Connection, multi-use pedestrian accommodation, Steuben and Dace Streets remain open, Bacon Creek Conduit North Alignment, and replace South and Middle Conduit. Under the on-alignment alternative, which the city prefers, the existing viaduct would be completely replaced in the same general location along Gordon Drive from Virginia Street to Fairmont Street. The other option is the south-adjacent alignment alternative, which involves building a new Gordon Drive just south of the existing viaduct from Virginia Street to Fairmont Street. New bridges would be built over the Floyd River and Union Pacific Railroad on the west end and over Bacon Creek and the BNSF Railroad on the east end. At the same time the viaduct is reconstructed, contractors will replace two arms of the Bacon Creek conduit, a portion of which was built in the year 1909, that run beneath Correctionville Road and Gordon Drive. You had a list of options that you would prefer to see. We're here tonight to kind of make sure that all of those are still what the city's preferences are, Schultz told the council. Schultz said replacing the viaduct adjacent to the existing viaduct provides separation, which he said makes the construction process a little bit easier. He said the duration of construction is also a bit shorter. There are some more property impacts with that, but as we've been working through from last year to this year, we've determined that it's less than an acre in the overall impacts, he said. The traffic operation during construction is similar to what you see today, so we can maintain four lanes for a majority of the replacement of the bridge. Schultz said there will be some maintenance and traffic issues when tie-ins are done on either end. He said there will be one lane or detours will be in place for short periods of time. One of the things it also does is it avoids major modifications to the existing viaduct, so it's just a matter of holding the existing one together during construction while we're building the new one, he said. Schultz said the south adjacent alignment alternative involved removing a portion of existing viaduct and leaving one lane open in each direction on the north half of the bridge, while building the south half or the eastbound lanes. Then, once that's done, we switch traffic one lane in each direction and build the westbound, said Schultz, who noted that construction and staging are more complex with this option. We are looking at building the bridge twice, essentially. We're looking at tear down half, build half, tear down the other half, build the other half. It's more complex, and with that, it takes a little bit more time. The IDOT has taken the lead in designing the entire project. Viaduct replacement is estimated at $118 to $144 million, and the conduit is estimated at $25 million to $34 million. We are refreshing that. I can promise you it's higher, Schultz said. The viaduct, which carries 20,000 vehicles daily, is in need of replacement, rather than simply adding on to it as in past improvements. The project also will require some realignment of the Gordon Drive/Lewis Boulevard interchange. The century-old Bacon Creek conduit, which runs 2,542 feet from Ruston Street beneath Gordon Drive and Lewis Boulevard before flowing into the former Floyd River Channel and into the Missouri River, has concrete erosion and exposed steel reinforcement bars. The city will pay for the conduit replacement, utility relocation, and other costs. Jessica Felix, IDOT District 3 engineer, told the council that the IDOT is looking at opportunities to harness its technology and work with its contracting partners on the project. "It's one of the longest structures in the state of Iowa," she said of the viaduct. "It is going to take time to build it, but we will do it as expedient as possible." Schultz said meetings for landowners and stakeholders would likely take place in April. He said a public hearing where the preferred alternative is unveiled would follow. Now we've come to an article entitled "Satanic Temple Display at Capitol Sparks Debate." It's written by Caleb McCullough of the Journal Des Moines Bureau. The dateline is Des Moines. Iowans touring the state capitol this week will see two displays, one installed by the Satanic Temple and the other a nativity scene, that have sparked a debate about free expression and religious liberty. The Satanic Temple Iowa, a chapter of a national organization, installed the display last week that features a statue of Baphomet, a goat-headed figure often used to represent Satan. The display also features seven tenets upheld by the Satanic Temple and is set to remain up until Saturday, according to a calendar maintained by the Department of Administrative Services. The Thomas More Society, a conservative law firm, installed the nativity scene in the state capitol on Tuesday that will remain for 2 weeks. Images of the Satanic Temple display circulated on social media last week and sparked calls for the state to remove it, including from at least one Republican state lawmaker. Others argued the display is religious expression protected by the First Amendment. In a statement on Tuesday, Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said she disagrees with the display, but implored opponents to engage in speech and prayer rather than remove the display. "Like many Iowans, I find the Satanic Temple's display in the Capitol absolutely objectionable," Reynolds said in a statement. "In a free society, the best response to objectionable speech is more speech, and I encourage all those of faith to join me today in praying over the Capitol and recognizing the nativity scene that will be on display, the true reason for the season." In a statement on Monday, the Satanic Temple Iowa said it was proud to take part in the holiday season at the state capitol. "The tenets portrayed on the statue," the group said, "advocate for bodily autonomy, a rejection of arbitrary authority, recognizing our own fallibility, and inspiring nobility in thought and action, which we hope enlightens the viewer to our beliefs and inspires one to reflect upon their own approach to the world. We thank the staff of the Capitol, the Capitol Police, and the Department of Administrative Services for holding fast to the principle of religious freedom and ensuring all religions have an equal opportunity to celebrate the holidays together in our beautiful capital," the group said in a statement. The Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, a liberal advocacy organization, said in a statement on Tuesday that Reynolds' comments about the display is disrespectful to people who are not Christian. "The governor of Iowa may be Christian herself, but in this democracy grounded in religious freedom, she is not a Christian governor," said Connie Ryan, the group's executive director. "She should never elevate one belief above all other beliefs. She is accountable to every Iowan. She should promise to do better and to inclusively represent and uphold the freedoms of every Iowan, regardless of the political influences to do otherwise." Republicans differ on legal response. In a newsletter on December the 8th, State Representative Brad Sherman, a Republican from Williamsburg, said he disagrees with that the Satanic display is protected free speech and called for Reynolds to remove it. He pointed to the Iowa Constitution, which states that the people of Iowa are grateful to the Supreme Being for the blessings hitherto enjoyed. He said that clause implies that the state is founded on a Christian interpretation of God, and Iowa must depend on God for continued success. It is a tortured and twisted interpretation of law that affords Satan, who is universally understood to be the enemy of God, religious expression equal to God in an institution of government that depends upon God for continued blessings, he wrote. Sherman further called for legislation to state that satanic displays are not allowed on state property, and legislation allowing the display of the Ten Commandments in the Capitol and school buildings. State Representative John Dunwell, a Republican from Newton, said he does not support the satanic temple display, but that it should remain up in order to ensure that religious freedom is protected. The divide represents a rift in the Republican Party between Christian nationalists, he said, and those who think the government should not privilege any religion. As an American and as a politician, my number one concern is freedom, he said in an interview Tuesday. I do not want the government telling me what's an appropriate religious display and what is not an appropriate religious display. Because if they can do that against something that I find objectionable, at some point, that same government can do that to me. Christians commemorate nativity display. In an event commemorating the nativity scene on Tuesday, speakers made frequent reference to the satanic temple display nearby, although none called for the display to be taken down. Reynolds attended the ceremony, but she did not speak. Ahead of the ceremony on Tuesday, Barb Chapman of Urbandale was praying in front of the satanic temple display. She said she is not opposed to the display being up, but that she was praying for the people involved to change their views and become Christians. I don't hate them for it. I'm just sorry that they don't know the love of God, or I don't think they would oppose him, she said. Mike Damastis, the pastor of Fort Des Moines Church of Christ, said he thinks the display was installed to poke the bear and offend Christians, and that the display is not in line with Iowa's cultural tradition. While he does not want the display to be up, he said he does not know whether it can be legally taken down. My gut feeling was I wanted to come and tear it down personally, he said, but I also need to be a law-abiding citizen. Now I'll read an article from the Storm Lake Times-Pilot, which is entitled Suit Set on TIF Funds. Final Demand Accuses County of Gaslighting. It's written by Tom Cullen and Amber Muhammad. The city of Storm Lake is expected to file a lawsuit by next Monday against Buena Vista County over millions of misallocated tax increment financing, or TIF, revenues over a 9-year period. Bill Miller, a Des Moines attorney representing the city, wrote in a letter on Monday that the Storm Lake City Council will be authorizing at its next meeting to file a lawsuit over the misallocated TIF revenue, currently estimated at around $5 million. The city is at a loss why the county has chosen to proceed as it has in recent months, which has moved past ignoring the circumstances and refusing to make a good faith effort to make the city whole, to denying the county has information it has long held in a seeming attempt to gaslight city officials, Miller wrote in the letter on Monday to Katie Graham, a Des Moines attorney representing the county. It is unfortunate that we have reached this point, and if the county has any interest in resolving this matter without litigation, we ask that you propose a path forward to make the city whole by no later than December the 15th, 2023. County Attorney Paul Allen declined comment, citing imminent litigation. Graham declined comment, referring to the barbs between the city and county as settlement communications. In the letter on Monday, Miller accused the county's representatives of disingenuousness in its recent discussions with the city. The county allegedly withheld documents the city claims it's owed. The county allegedly conveyed confusion about the city's concerns or its demands to be made whole. Miller asserted that the county's representatives were precisely aware of the city's concerns. The county also asked for information about parcels where tax increment financing applies and council resolutions related to tax increment financing, according to the letter. Miller claims those records are already in the county's hands and the county knew or should have known they are. While the city has continually supplied the county in While the city has continually supplied the county information, it has not received the same consideration in return, reads Miller's letter, which accused the county of ignoring an October records request. The city already imposed a deadline for the county to come up with a response to the misallocated TIF revenue. The city council met twice in closed session over the last 3 weeks to discuss matters of litigation. The city was poised to sue the county. The county blew past a December 1st deadline to submit a meaningful resolution to the city council. Graham, the county's attorney, wrote in a letter last month that the city hasn't provided any additional detail or clarity on the issues relating to the city's alleged harm. No resolution was offered. This letter is intended to more clearly set forth the county's position and to gain a better understanding of precisely what your client is claiming, Graham's letter reads. The sides aren't any closer to settling than what they were when the last deadline passed. A lawsuit wasn't filed then. Nothing has been said about the city council's criteria for initiating litigation. Last Monday's hour-long closed session yielded little in terms of a resolution with the county, according to Mayor Mike Porsche, who declined to specify the nature of the imminent litigation that warranted a closed meeting. I can't get into timelines, anything like that, Porsche said. I can't get into anything that was said. No lawsuits naming both the city and county have been filed in state or federal courts as of Monday. At one time, the city and county agreed on how the city would be paid back. Last November, the city and county agreed to a solution that was offered by the Iowa Department of Management: extend the statutory sunsets on tax increment financing collections in the districts where the misallocations occurred. The proposed arrangements would effectively pay back the city for TIF distributions that the county auditor's office erroneously sent to other taxing entities. The city calculated an estimate of its losses. Brian Oakleaf, the city's finance manager, discovered a myriad of curious valuations in the city's urban renewal areas, geographic locations where tax increment financing is codified. The base value of the industrial park at one time jumped from $9.3 million to $12.7 million. The base value is the valuation that is original to a parcel before tax increment financing is applied. The increment value, or the improvements that are subject to TIF divisions, dipped from $12.7 million to $9.8 million. Oakleaf reasoned the valuation changes made no sense. The original area was worth more than its subsequent improvements. The implication was that the industrial park was worth more without Kings Point Resort than with it. Other curious discrepancies kept popping up. The only reason we found out about this was because the Tyson Feed Mill submitted their receipt, which led to us reviewing the Kings Point receipt, which led to more receipts, historical information from Iowa Department of Management Director Ted Nelson, and to all the work that I have provided, Oakleaf wrote in an email to Lloyd last fall. The county then sent the city's figures to Iowa Communities Assurance Pool, the county insurers, according to correspondence recently obtained by the Storm Lake Times Pilot. The city documented $4.65 million in lost TIF revenue from the Bargloff area, the Kings Point Resort area, the industrial park, the Tyson Feed Mill, and other parcels that were found to be left out of the auditor's tax increment financing records altogether, according to a letter Oakleaf sent to the county's insurance company May 2nd, a letter that previously was not disclosed to the public. The letter alleges the city lost $3.3 million from the Kings Point area from 2013 to 2022, according to Oakleaf's letter. It lost $880,000 from miscalculations on the Tyson Feed Mill project and from seven parcels that the auditor's office allegedly admitted that it failed to include in TIF calculations, according to the letter. With documented losses of $4,651,033.43, the city of Storm Lake estimated, with all of the outstanding questions remaining, that the total losses suffered by the city due to the county's error would reasonably be over $5 million, reads Oakleaf's letter, which implies the alleged miscalculations could have occurred as early as 1992. There are many parcels in many years that have yet to be investigated, Oakleaf's letter continues. Both representatives from the county auditor's office agreed with the figures provided and stated their own calculations were similar. They also agreed that further work on the outstanding questions would no doubt increase the amount of loss and take a large amount of effort and time from the city and the county. ICAP denied the county's $5 million claim. So the city and the county went back to the drawing board. In the spring, the city hired Miller just after the claim was denied. The county hired Nymaster Good to deal with Miller. Over time, the city became less enthused about collecting tax increment financing revenues to recoup for what is alleged to be decades of mistakes. The city needed to issue tens of millions in debt to build the infrastructure that would foster growth in those TIF areas. Around $27.6 million in debt still needs to be repaid. Hence, the city couldn't accept the county's offer. At first it did, but later reversed course for reasons yet to be revealed. Navratil recently described the county's offer as a payoff that it be realized after I'm dead. Miller wrote in a letter last month that the county's proposal didn't contemplate state legislation that could constrain the city's ability to collect TIF revenue as it currently does. The legislation, said to be under consideration by the Republican majority, is expected to limit the length of time cities can collect TIF revenues from blighted areas, TIF districts with no statutory sunset on revenue collections. Miller also noted the county's proposal assumed that other taxing entities would be forced to forego future collections, all because of mistakes they didn't make. In his most recent letter, Miller demanded the county include an unequivocal commitment to immediately pay the city what it's owed. Any other suggestion, including extension of the sunsets, would be viewed as the county's refusal to accept responsibility for its omitted errors, omissions, or negligence. I'm going to read the editorial from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, and it's Starving Out Beavers is the title of the piece. It's written by the editor and publisher, Art Cullen. If you love Storm Lake, you are a beaver. We are beavers, even though we never took a class at Buena Vista University. BVU is Storm Lake, and vice versa. You cannot separate the two. Buena Vista is an irreplaceable economic engine and cultural asset for Iowa, with its main campus here and satellites spread throughout the state on community college campuses. Buena Vista is Iowa. Our greatest coaches and teachers are beavers. Bernie Sagow. Nobody produced more school leaders over the years for Iowa than Buena Vista. We also have a special fondness for Drake, which produced Iowa coach Lisa Bluter and assistant Jan Jensen, and Clark in Dubuque, even Wartburg, it's all in the family. It was thus a special treat to have lunch recently with Buena Vista President Brian Lensmeyer. He clued us in on the money he has to raise to make certain that BVU is chewing through the hubris of ignorance 10 years from now. The numbers are so big, it boggles the mind, and no, it's not because beavers need to live in swanky dens. Lensmeyer said in a stunning number on the table, half of BVU's freshman class are first-generation college students. No place else, except for maybe Simpson, has a rate like that. Most of them come from within 250 miles of Storm Lake. Mainly, they are white. A fair number of students are students of color from the immediate vicinity. Now, consider that three-fourths of Iowa private college graduates stay in the state after graduation. Most of these first-generation BVU grads will stay in Northwest Iowa, paying taxes and building communities. A week later, we were stunned and deflated to read that the geniuses running the Iowa legislature are seriously discussing changing or even curtailing the Iowa tuition grant program upon which Buena Vista, Drake, and all Iowa private colleges vitally depend. Representative Carter Nordman, a Republican from Adel, told Iowa Capitol Dispatch that he has had conversations with other legislators about changing the tuition grant program so it would apply to majors that lead to jobs the state desires. Sounds like nurses would be in luck, while philosophy students would be even more in debt. The state would pick winners and losers. Winners, biology majors. Losers, English majors. Nordman is 25 and was graduated from the University of Northern Iowa with a business major. He told Iowa Capitol Dispatch there is another reason for trying to scare private college presidents. We're going to keep an eye on the situation as far as the rhetoric that's been happening on some of the university's campuses, Nordman said. He must have awfully sensitive ears for rhetoric. The University of Dubuque is not Harvard, and Briarcliff is not Columbia or Penn. Can you imagine Drake being anti-Semitic with its many Jewish students? That's absurd. Grandview anti-Palestinian? Come on. Take an antidote to the cult elixir. Buena Vista offers rodeo and farm op. Are you kidding? The conflict in the Middle East is not burning among the central Dutch in Pella. Wartburg would mainly like to pay off its debts. Upper Iowa is gasping for air. Simpson is fighting the good fight for poor folks in southern Iowa, whether Nordman knows it or not. It takes money to lift a kid from Ringgold County into a degree from Simpson, or a kid from Galva to become a coach, seed scientist, or banker through Buena Vista. That takes the Iowa tuition grant, which is only around $7,000. Lensmeyer is charged with finding the other $30,000 or so per first-generation student so they do not graduate with an art degree and $100,000 in debt. He takes it very seriously and thinks about it 24/7. He knows what it is like to be a kid from Willmar, Minnesota, who depended on financial aid to go to St. John's University. The Minnesota tuition grant is under no similar threat. The tuition grant is a voucher. The legislature just passed a voucher for K-12 private schools while attempting to undermine Iowa private colleges and universities because certain Republicans don't like what is going on at Drake or Luther. You could make a strong argument that Drake is far more important to Des Moines than Dowling is as a world-class private university. The K-12 voucher pays more than the tuition grant and will outpace it every year according to the schedule. We hope that Don Lamberti, David Young, and Harry Stein can knock some sense into these jokers. It is not as if the average Buena Vista Don were living the life of a prince. They have to eat, too. That takes money. Iowa is said to have nearly a $2 billion surplus, and legislators are talking about more tax cuts. This is the result. Cut off Buena Vista. When it is no more, add up the cumulative effect of your tax cut prorated to the share that the Iowa tuition grant would have consumed. It might buy you a case of Bush Light and a bucket of wings. If you are a legislator, you could probably get some help on the equation from President Lensmeyer. If anything, we should double the tuition grants and means test the K-12 voucher program if it's money thereafter. If they're looking for terrorists, we would suggest they look somewhere else other than Storm Lake or Decorah. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now I'll read the obituaries from today's Storm Lake Times Pilot. First, Rose Sackett, age 81, of Schaller, passed away peacefully December the 8th, 2023, at her home. There will be no service at this time. Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake is in charge of the arrangements. Rose was born in Eden Valley, Minnesota, to Daniel and Mildred Christie. Rose was united in marriage to Ray Fenton Sackett in 1960. Once their children got older, Rose and Ray became owner-operators of Ray and Rose Sackett Trucking, and Rose joined Ray on the road for a few years under the CB handle as Mountain Dew and him as Flipper. After being on the road with Ray, Rose got a job at Casey's in Storm Lake, her longest and by far favorite job. Rose loved working at Casey's. She worked there for almost 25 years. She enjoyed all the customers and the employees she worked with. After working at Casey's until her retirement, she worked at Sodexo USA for a couple years. She enjoyed all the college kids as well until her health no longer allowed. After working at Sodexo USA, she enjoyed volunteering at the SOS as they needed her. Next is Charles Allen Chuck Vredenburg, who was born in January 23, 1955 in Albia. At 68 years of age, he passed away on December 1, 2023 after a sudden decline in his health. A celebration of life was held Saturday, December the 9th at McLaren's Rest Haven Chapel in West Des Moines. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to Furry Friends Refuge or Food Bank of Iowa, both organizations Chuck cared passionately for. Please visit www.mclarensresthavenchapel.com for expressions of sympathy. And finally, Michael P. Reinert, age 72, of Alta, died Sunday, December the 10th, 2023, at Buena Vista Regional Medical Center in Storm Lake. Funeral Mass will take place Saturday, December the 16th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Storm Lake. Burial will be in Woodlawn Cemetery in Alta. Visitation will take place Friday, December the 15th from 4 to 8 p.m. at Fratsky and Jensen Funeral Home in Storm Lake. Now it's time to turn to sports, and we'll start with some local sports from the Storm Lake Times-Pilot. Storm Lake boys win overtime thriller over Spirit Lake in Lake's opener. Carson Lohman was in the right place at the right time. The Storm Lake seniors' offensive putback as time expired capped a rally in the final 3 minutes to tie the game and force overtime, and the Tornadoes went on to beat Spirit Lake 74-70 in the Lake's conference opener for both teams last Friday at Tornado Fieldhouse. Storm Lake held a 19-15 lead after the first quarter and took a 35-31 lead at halftime. The Tornadoes led 47-36 in the third quarter, but Spirit Lake went on an 18-2 run to take a 54-49 lead with about 5 minutes and 30 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter. Spirit Lake led 60-53 with 3 minutes and 30 seconds remaining when Justin Gwynn scored 7 straight points, including a steal and layup, to tie the game at 60-60 with 1 minute and 44 seconds left. Wesley Walls made a layup with 6.9 seconds left to give Spirit Lake a 62-60 lead. Gwynn drove the length of the floor and a shot rimmed off, but Lohman's offensive putback at the buzzer tied it at 62. Spirit Lake went ahead 65-62 in the extra session, but Storm Lake scored 7 unanswered points to go ahead 69-65. Cam Boyd's three-pointer with a minute and 30 seconds left gave Storm Lake the lead for good at 68-65. Spirit Lake got as close as 73-70, but a three-pointer rimmed out and Boyd made a free throw with 2.6 seconds left. Gwynn scored 22 points to lead Storm Lake. Boyd added 20 and Jaden Kuhn had 14. David William had 8 points, Lohman 5, Charlie DeVerksten 3, and Tim Yanga 2. DeVerksten and Lohman led in rebounding with 8 apiece. Kuhn had 7 and Boyd had 6. Boyd and Yanga each netted 4 assists. Kuhn and Gwynn had 2 apiece. Gwynn tallied 3 steals and Kuhn 2. Kuhn also blocked 2 shots. Storm Lake made 28 of 62 field goals for 45%, including 7-20 from 3-point range. It was a big win for our guys, Storm Lake coach Evan Franzmeier said. All 5 of our starters this year played last year when we went 2-6 in the Lakes Conference. So this is a statement game for us and sets us up for the tough Lakes Conference schedule that's upcoming. I thought we did a great job rebounding and taking care of the ball, Franzmeier added. We won both of those categories, which leads to us winning games. Our seniors came up big in a big game. Carson Lohman started in a little foul trouble, but in the second half he did a lot of good things for us, including putting in the game-tying shot to force OT. Carson is always in the right spot at the right time with 6 huge offensive rebounds. Justin Gwynn was awesome all night attacking the rim. He does so much for us on both ends of the floor. Overall, I'm very happy for our guys and the toughness this team has to withstand a 18-2 run by Spirit Lake and still come out on top. Storm Lake girls suffer first loss of season in Lake's opener. Spirit Lake jumped out to a 10-2 lead early and used a 16-7 spurt in the third quarter to retake control as the Indians handed Storm Lake its first loss of the season, 55-45 in the Lakes Conference opener for both teams last Friday at Tornado Fieldhouse. Spirit Lake had held a 15-8 lead after the first quarter and led 23-20 at the half. The game was tied at 23 early in the third quarter, but the Indians would take a 39-30 lead into the fourth quarter and would extend that lead to 13 points with under 6 minutes to play. Storm Lake could get no closer than 8 points the rest of the way. Idea Yangi scored 20 points to lead Storm Lake. Avery DeHaan added 10 and Maddie Raveling 8. Audrey Koski had 3 points, while Abby Bodholt and Grace Kenkel each added 2. Yenga and DeHaan grabbed 6 rebounds. Koski and Mackenzie Harder added 4 apiece. DeHaan charted 4 assists. Yenga had 3, and Harder and Raveling 2 apiece. DeHaan had tallied 2 steals. Storm Lake made 14 of 42 field goals for 33%, including 3 of 18 from 3-point range. We started slow and dug ourselves into too big of a hole, Storm Lake coach Nate Reichter said. We turned the ball over too much. I thought the girls gave great effort, worked really hard, and just had an off night shooting the ball. We need to cut down on turnovers and limit points off them. Adia played very well and attacked the rim. She was definitely the bright spot for us. In our next story, BVU men rally to get past Luther. Zane Newbaum scored a game-high 25 points, with Gunnar Reed and Ryan Mendoza each adding 13 points, and the trio helped lead Buena Vista to a thrilling 74-71 victory over Luther College last Saturday in Siebens Fieldhouse. It was a back-and-forth game from the opening tip, with neither team able to build a lead the entire game. Luther was aided by 6 made three-pointers and shot better than 48% from the field in the opening half. But despite shooting under 38% from the field overall, the Beavers clung to a 36-35 lead at the half. The Norse opened the second half with back-to-back three-pointers to grab its largest lead at 41-36, but BVU stayed within striking distance the entire way. Newbaum scored 17 of his 25 points in the second half as BVU shot over 65%. Luther later held a 71-67 lead with 2 minutes and 12 seconds remaining before Mendoza made a transition three-pointer from right in front of the Beaver bench with 1 minute to play that gave BVU a 72-71 advantage. The Norse came up empty on their next possession and then were forced to foul. Mendoza later made both free throws on a 1-on-1 trip to extend the lead to 74-71 with 18 seconds left. Following a missed layup by Luther on its next trip down the court, the Beavers grabbed the rebound and Isaiah Adams was fouled and sent to the line to shoot a 1-on-1 with over 3 seconds left. He missed the free throw and Luther had one final chance, but their three-point attempt after a pair of timeouts came up short. Newbaum finished 11 of 22 from the field overall and made 3 of 9 from three-point range. He also grabbed 7 rebounds and had 1 steal. Reed was a perfect 5-for-5 from the field and 2-for-2 for the charity stripe. In addition to his 13 points, he also grabbed 11 rebounds for his first double-double of the year. Mendoza also made 3 of 4 from long range and charted 2 assists. Michael Santich chipped in with 7 points and tallied a team-high 5 assists. The Beavers finished the game shooting 49.1% from the field overall and made 9 of 24 from three-point range and 11 of 13 from the free throw line. Daniel Webster scored 20 points to lead Luther, which dropped its 6th straight game overall. Buena Vista improved to a record of 6-3 overall. And BVU women can't recover from early deficit in ARC loss to Luther. The Buena Vista women's basketball team returned to American Rivers Conference play to host Luther College, but the Beavers fell behind big in the first quarter and were never able to recover en route to a 75-37 setback to the Norse last Saturday. Luther scored the first 25 points of the game before a pair of McKenna Cone free throws in the final 2 minutes of the opening quarter got BVU on the scoreboard, while Allie Leisher added a jumper with under a minute to play that made it 25-4 after the first 10 minutes. The second quarter was much tighter, but the Beavers were never able to mount any threat and trailed 39-16 at the break. Both teams shot better than 40% throughout the third quarter before the Norse built their largest lead at 39 points midway through the fourth quarter. The Beavers struggled to shoot from 3 points in the game, making only 1 of 24 from beyond the arc, and finished the game shooting only 23.6% from the field overall. Cone led BVU with 9 points and 5 rebounds, while Abby Nagel was right behind with 8 points, including 4 of 5 from the charity stripe. Danica Demers chipped in with 6 points, a team-high 9 rebounds, and charted 4 assists and added 3 steals. Haley Strum and Lizzie Calls each scored 15 points to lead Luther. Buena Vista falls to a record of 1 win and 6 losses overall, 0-3 in the ARC, and will host Martin Luther today at 6 p.m. Next is an article from the Sioux City Journal sports section. It's the men's college basketball top 25 roundup, and it's entitled Filipowski's Almost Triple-Double Helps Duke Pull Away from Hofstra. Kyle Filipowski knocked down shots, attacked the glass, and set up teammates on kickouts. By the end of the night, he had flirted with a triple-double while number 21 Duke pulled away after halftime for a comfortable win. The 7-foot preseason Associated Press All-American had 28 points, 12 rebounds, and a career-best 8 assists as the Blue Devils beat Hofstra 89-68 on Tuesday night, turning in a productive all-around performance that included 4 three-pointers and 3 block shots. Coach John Shire said Filipowski was just a force, coming after what he had just 17 points in his previous 2 games combined and shot 2 for 10 in his last outing. "I think for me, it was just a little mental," Filipowski said, "but I've got a great supporting cast, great teammates, great coaches. They keep their confidence high in me, and when I don't overthink it, things tend to go really well. Getting out of that funk, just playing, having fun, it's a great feeling." Duke shot 55%, made 11 of 22 three-pointers, and had 4 players in double figures while playing again without injured point guard Tyrese Proctor. Jeremy Roach added 19 points and 8 assists for Duke, which trailed 37-32 late in the first half before closing on a 12-2 burst before the break. That included a run of 5 straight made shots, a flurry that continued into the second half as Filipowski hit one right corner 3 and then another to eventually push Duke to a 55-43. Number 12 Tennessee beats Georgia Southern. Jonas Idu had 29 points and 11 rebounds, and number 12 Tennessee beat Georgia Southern 74-56 on Tuesday night. The windless Eagles had no answer for the 6'11 Idu, who also had 2 steals and 2 blocks. Idu was the only double-digit scorer for the Volunteers. After trailing by as many as 28 points shortly after halftime, Georgia Southern cut the difference to 13 with a 10-point spurt midway through the second half. Derek Harris came off the bench to score all but 2 of his 13 points in the second half for the Eagles. Idu scored the first 10 points of the game and had 21 by halftime as the Vols led 49-21. In NFL notes, Hebert done for season after having finger surgery. Justin Hebert had surgery on Tuesday on the broken index finger on his right hand and will miss the Los Angeles Chargers' remaining 4 games this season. Hebert visited 2 hand specialists on Monday after he suffered the injury during the second quarter of Los Angeles' 24-7 loss to the Denver Broncos on Sunday. "He is as tough as they come, but we're going to make sure that whatever it is, we're going to do what is best for Justin long-term," Coach Brandon Staley said on Monday. Easton Stick will get his first NFL start on Thursday night at Las Vegas against the Raiders. The Chargers are 5-8 and have dropped 4 of their past 5. From the Minnesota Vikings, Nick Mullins will be the starting quarterback for Minnesota this Saturday at Cincinnati. He relieved an ineffective Joshua Dobbs last week and helped lead the Vikings to a 3-0 victory at Las Vegas. Mullins is the 4th different starter for the Vikings. They've never used that many in the same season before in franchise history. Dobbs arrived in a trade with Arizona after Kirk Cousins tore his Achilles tendon. Cleveland Browns lost its 2nd starting offensive tackle in 2 days as Jedrick Wills Jr. underwent season-ending knee surgery. Wills had been on injured reserve since November the 7th, and the Browns had hoped the left tackle would be able to return at some point this season. However, the 2020 first-round pick from Alabama elected to have an operation and won't be back until 2024. Los Angeles Rams cut veteran kicker Mason Crosby from their practice squad after incumbent Lucas Haverick had a strong game at Baltimore. The Rams also placed rookie long snapper Alex Ward on injured reserve and signed veteran long snapper Carson Tinker. Crosby signed with Los Angeles last week, returning to the NFL after his 16-year career in Green Bay ended last winter. And the Baltimore Ravens activated defensive back Pepe Williams off injured reserve. Williams hasn't played this season because of ankle problems. He appeared in 14 games last season as a rookie. The Ravens designated Williams to return from IR on November the 21st, but did not activate him until now. In NBA news, Jordan headlines first Bulls Ring of Honor. Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and Dennis Rodman are the headliners for the inaugural class of the Chicago Bulls Ring of Honor. The Bulls unveiled their plans for the Ring of Honor on Tuesday. The first class includes 13 men and the 1995-96 team, which went 72-10 and won the NBA title. The franchise plans to honor the group with a couple of events in January. The inaugural class also includes Phil Jackson, Jerry Krause, Artis Gilmore, Jerry Sloan, Tony Kukoc, Bob Love, Chet Walker, Johnny Red Kerr, Tex Winter, and Dick Klein. Jackson coached the 95-96 team, which had Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, and Kukoc, with Krause leading the front office and Winter serving as an assistant coach. The Chicago Bulls Ring of Honor will be the first of its kind celebration honoring many of the legends who have helped shape our organization over the past 57 years, Bulls president Michael Reinsdorf said in a release. They have deep connections to our fans and community and represent a spirit of competition, hard work, and toughness. The Ring of Honor festivities include a private gala at the United Center on January the 11th and a halftime presentation during a January 12th game against Golden State. Scores from around the NBA. The Dallas Mavericks beat the Los Angeles Lakers 127-125 on Tuesday. The Celtics 120, Cavaliers 113. The Nuggets defeated the Chicago Bulls 114-106. Phoenix Suns defeated the Golden State Warriors 119-116. And Los Angeles Clippers 119, Sacramento Kings 99. Scores from around the NHL. The Maple Leafs beat the New York Rangers 7-3 Tuesday night. The Penguins 4, Coyotes 2, Hurricanes 4, Senators 1. Red Wings defeated the St. Louis Blues 6-4. Predators defeated the Flyers 3-2 in overtime. The Canucks defeated the Lightning 4-1. The Kraken defeated the Panthers 4-0. The Golden Knights 6, Flames 5 in overtime. And Oilers 4, Blackhawks 1. We're going to wrap things up today with a humor article written by Jerry Zezima of the Tribune News Service, and it's entitled Withering Heights. All my life, I thought I would end up in the gutter. Last week, it almost happened, so it's a good thing I have gutter guards. I got them because leaves, twigs, and acorns had clogged the gutter so much that there was barely room for my mind, which was in there, too. When my wife, Sue, and I moved into our house 25 years ago, the gutters didn't have guards. I had to climb to the top of the two-story colonial to clean out the leaves every fall. I came to the frightening realization that the word fall could also apply to me. That's because I have acrophobia, which is an extreme fear of heights. Since I am 6 feet tall, this means I'm afraid of being any higher off the ground than the top of my head. So we got gutter guards, which enabled me to stand safely on terra firma instead of shaking like a leaf on the roof where I could almost see people in passing airplanes laughing at me. When we got a new roof a few years ago, our ace contractor, Anthony Amini, took me up there to check out the job and alleviate my fears. It didn't work because one of my sneakers became untied and I just stood there, frozen in terror and afraid to bend over to lace up my size 11 shoe. Anthony kindly did it for me. After I climbed down, which took roughly as long as the Super Bowl halftime show, I vowed never to go up on the roof again. A couple of years ago, Anthony and his great crew replaced the siding on the house and installed new gutters. Unfortunately, they didn't come with guards. Not wanting rain spillage to get behind the siding and damage the walls, and refusing to relive haunting memories of the days when I had to clean the gutters myself, I arranged for Anthony and his terrific assistant, Carlos Garcia, to put on new gutter guards. They came over with several boxes of the thick metal strips, which are perforated to allow rain through, but which prevent gutters from being filled with ugly brown foliage and other disgusting gunk. Before installing them on both the dizzying upper roof and the two lower but still scary roofs, Anthony and Carlos cleaned the gutters. After the guards had been attached, Anthony invited me up to a lower roof to check them out. Even though it's only about 10 feet above the backyard, I was petrified at the prospect. "I'll hold the ladder," he assured me. "Climb slowly and don't look down." Things were looking up because I made it without sliding off and landing on my head, in which case, of course, I wouldn't have been hurt. "What do you think?" Anthony asked. "I think I'm about to go into cardiac arrest," I stammered. "No, I mean about the gutter guards," he said. "They're great," I replied, "nice and shiny." "And they'll keep all that nasty stuff out of your gutters," Anthony promised. "Wonderful," I said. "Can I get down now?" After taking a picture of me admiring my new gutter guards, "It could run with my obituary," I suggested. Anthony tried to help me get one foot onto the top rung of the ladder. "Wait a minute," I said. "I have a better idea." I pulled out my cell phone and called Sue so she could let me into the house through the bathroom window on the second floor. She didn't answer, but Anthony finally succeeded in getting me onto the ladder and talking me down. Just then, Sue came outside. "You didn't fall," she said. "Disappointed?" I asked. "Not really," she answered with a smile. "Good," I said. "At least I didn't end up in the gutter." That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, for the blog.